All right. So the band is Balin. Their name comes from their family name. The three people who front the band are all siblings, and they sound like it. You know, man, it's pretty lovely. Anyway, a couple of lyrics we'll touch on. We'll come back to the song in a bit. How is it so, day come, day go, and I can see the rise of a fallen fight? Hear 'em go, just marching on the quicksand. This is a marching on the quicksand paved in gold. That was the first line in the song when I heard it the first time, where I was just like, oh, where's this going? What an interesting picture of the fragility of wealth and power and positional thinking. Marching on the quicksand paved in gold. And I can see it now, the red flag waving in the light of day, and they won't take it down. Nothing's going to change till we all can say, I believe that I was wrong. I believe we can move along. Move along if we can say, I believe that I was wrong. And then the verse that I mentioned off the top, born from the earth, one beat, one birth. But call your brother blind, say that you're the one with vision. Lend an ear. We sure can talk, but can we hear? Because years won't make you wise if you don't try to listen, and so on. Well, like I said, we'll come back to it, but some good stuff going on in there. Sometimes I hear something, kind of like a fragment of sound, like a little caught thing that comes into my life from the periphery, not from the center. By the way, did you know that we respond fastest physically to things that come from the periphery, not that come from the center? We're evolved to react most acutely to things that we don't see coming because they're the most dangerous, right? So that's kind of interesting, even in terms of ideas and how we think about ideas and how they come at us. So I try to pay attention when something's an idea comes at me from the side instead of one that I was looking for and preparing for. And so sometimes those things, they're kind of like burrs. They don't seem very big when you encounter them, but they just glom on and they stick. And I had an experience like that a few weeks ago with a radio interview that I was driving, and I didn't have the radio on because of anything. It was just on in the car, and when the radio is just on in my vehicle, it's CBC, and so there was this interview going on. And because I kind of caught this, I don't think I'll get all the details right. I haven't been able to track down the actual content, although I have tried. So if, as I'm describing this to you, you recognize it and you can point me to a fuller version of this content, I'd appreciate it. Or if I get the particulars wrong, I'd appreciate knowing that too. So the person who was speaking, who was being interviewed, was an indigenous leader of some national status. I want to say a grand chief, but I'm not entirely sure that that's the case. But I recall enough about the speaker's content, about what they had to say, to know that their context was an important part of why I was so impacted by what I heard. This person was talking about changing the narrative. Not an unfamiliar phrase these days. More particularly, they were talking about how important it is to evolve the ways that we perceive and think about and talk about ourselves in the context of our surrounding cultures. And specifically, they were on about how this is important within the indigenous community. Just a quick aside here. I have been reminded several different ways lately that no group of people is homogenous. We talked about it this morning. It's conveniently simplistic and probably also culturally appropriative, not appropriate, but appropriative for me as a white guy to say something like indigenous people believe, as though an entire people group was like subject to groupthink or some sort of one-dimensional history. And that's absurd, of course. All I have to do to remind myself of the absurdity of that is say about pretty much anything white people think. So if you identify as white, do you want what you think to be lumped in with all white people? I'm not even talking about all white people, period. I'm just talking about all the white people in this room, you know. So, I do know that all of us in this room are not white-skinned or don't necessarily identify that way, and I'm just sticking to my lane for the illustration. But all to say this, I don't offer this particular memory of mine as representative of any group, but rather as a moment that just struck me in a really powerful way. within the context of my own limited understanding and limited experience about what it might mean to someone to be Indigenous. So this person that was being interviewed was talking about their understanding of common narratives that Indigenous people might have had put onto them, or that they might even hold about themselves, and how important it is to not get stuck in those. And as I remember what I heard, one of the particular narrative streams that they referenced regarding that was the "we are victims" narrative. I don't actually believe that anyone can look at the history of colonization on this continent or anywhere else on the planet, for that matter, and not see that some people have been victims in those events. That is unquestionably the case. And here in our country, the primary victims of colonization were Indigenous peoples. And so for this country's Indigenous folks, "we are victims" is a true statement about history. And because so many of the prevailing systems are those established under the powerful direction both of European colonizers and also men, lots of those victimizing patterns continue to this day. So to say something like the Indigenous people have been victims is just, in that regard, true. Which is one of the reasons why I found what this person had to say so powerful. Because the burr that got stuck in my thinking was when they said, and I'm pretty sure I've got this sentence verbatim, because it was just one of those shunk because of the context. They said, "we no longer find it helpful to think of ourselves as victims." I'd be way out of my lane if I said a sentence anything like that about people who claim indigeneity as their home place as a people. But for this Indigenous leader to say that felt like a pretty powerful thing. "We no longer find it helpful to think of ourselves as victims." Sometimes I try to imagine how much work it must be, like how much heartache, how much sweat, how much self-knowing it must take to even begin to unravel a narrative that has been hammered home as relentlessly as that one. I can't do it. It doesn't matter how hard I try, I can't do that. I can't even imagine that. But the fact that I heard someone that knows what it takes say what they said about this was what felt really deeply inspiring to me. And it gives me hope about the possibility of a different kind of story going forward in this country, a story in which we can live as equal partners in caring for the land that gives us life, where we can cultivate the various traditions that remind us of who we are, and we can do that with some grace toward one another, where we can learn to tell a story that makes room for all of us to evolve and grow as human beings. I felt some hope in that moment from my vantage point. So what I want to do this morning is humbly take a lesson from the wisdom of that leader. And because in this community I have a voice, I want to use that voice to pass the lesson along if I can. To me, the nugget, the shared takeaway was this. There are times in each of our personal stories and in our collective stories where we need to stop and examine our own narratives and say, "I/we no longer find it helpful to think of ourselves as fill in the blank. We no longer find it helpful to think of ourselves as, I no longer find it helpful to think of myself as." To do something like that probably means, for most of us, that we are going to enter a pretty complex space. Because it's a space, to do this kind of work, we have to enter a space in which we live within the tension of both clearly naming what has happened in the past and yet choosing to not have it ultimately define us going forward. So what's important about that is that the complexity of this space, it exists because it's not a space of denial. So this is really important. It's not a space in which we pretend that what happened didn't happen. Generally speaking, that's not helpful. Denying the past, you know, just pretending it didn't exist, not helpful. This is not a space in which, if we have been victims, for instance, This is not a space in which we turn a blind eye to that truth, but it is a space in which we do our best to both name that reality and not let it have the last word about the future. Complex. The reason I wanted to play that Balin tune for us was because one of the things that living in a space like the one that I'm trying to articulate this morning means that we have to learn to say, I was wrong. I held a belief that I can now see was wrong, a belief about others, a belief about an idea, a belief about myself, a belief about God, and I need to move along. I need to be able to say, I no longer find it helpful to believe X. That song feels to me like it has some insight in it that are beyond the years of the songwriters. I don't know if it struck you this way or not, or if you even listened to music this way, but the bridge that I climbed up, went down to the river to find strength for another day, I crisscrossed up the mountain, I never thought I'd find it so hard to say. To me, as soon as I hit that, I'm like, okay, you just went to gospel. Like, you just went to gospel musically as a form on purpose. Because you could have done that bridge a whole bunch of different ways, and that's where you went. Like, you're evoking something, and I need to pay attention to what's being evoked. The song actually bleeds through ideas, and this happens in some of other Balin songwriting. It suggests to me, and I don't know this biographically, I haven't spent the time to look it up, but there's something about the way they are coming at ideas that makes me think, oh, somewhere in this family story, there's some exposure to the Christian narrative, however that might be the case. But this bridge just really kind of caught my attention. I went down to the river to find strength for another day. I crisscrossed up the mountain. I never thought it'd be so hard to say, I believe that I was wrong. It's like they're saying to me, I thought I was going to go up the mountain to find reinforcement for what I already believed. I thought I'm going to church to be told I'm right. But what happened instead is that my journey led me to this need to acknowledge that I was wrong. It was a surprise. I thought I was going to get reinforcement, and what I got was challenge. I thought what I was going to get was, you're right. Now get back out there and convince everybody else that they should think like you. And what I got was, you're wrong. Now what are you going to do? Right? Oh, man, I never thought it'd be this hard to say I was wrong. To say that we are wrong, this might seem a little self-evident. Maybe this all seems self-evident. To say that we were wrong is to give something up. And sometimes, when we say we're wrong, what we need to give up might look like it's well worth abandoning, right? I mean, I'm a victim might sound like a narrative that nobody should want to keep around. But if that's how we've been defining ourselves, if it comes from somewhere that represents actual events, for instance, it just might not be that simple. The thing that we're saying, I believe I was wrong about that, or I no longer find it helpful to think of myself that way. The thing about which we are saying that might be a thing that was awful. Still true, but awful. But it might also, over time, have come to basically be the engine of our self-understanding. The critical way we define ourselves and understand ourselves. So, I am a victim is not an unusual engine of self-understanding for someone who has been a victim and been traumatized by it. So this is not a commentary on the legitimacy of acknowledging the truth of that. Again, that's what makes this space complex. It's not about denying the truth of those things. It's about not letting them have the last word about the future. So for an indigenous leader, for a grand chief in this country, to say, we no longer find it helpful to think of ourselves as victims, and then to go on and talk about a picture of the future for indigeneity that is bright with hope and possibility. Huh. It kind of took my breath away then. It kind of still does. And I feel like in that conversation, this is an aside, but I feel like from where I sit listening to that conversation, that theme is just bubbling up over and over again. It's bubbling up in young art makers, indigenous art makers, who are writing, among other things, talk about taking back your terrain. they're writing indigenous science fiction. And I'm not just talking about a science fiction story into which we insert, you know, like Tonto, okay, or some token indigenous character. I'm talking about deeply indigenous science fiction. It's absolutely fascinating. At least, you know, I mean, I don't know how the indigenous community is responding, but when I hear these artists talk about the art they're making and where they're coming from making it, something just goes off inside of me that's about hope. That just says, what kind of visionary belief in the possibilities of the future does it take to have the history that is undeniable and could produce a just I can't shake it off narrative of we are victims and that's how we're going to live, to having somebody going, my life work is to imagine a future that is nothing like the past without denying the past. Wow. To choose to move along from something awful might feel a lot like saying to ourselves, I was wrong, not about the events, but about what we have taken them to mean about us. Different things. And of course, sometimes saying I was wrong means that we're giving up a place of privilege or comfort or power or status, you know. Perceiving ourselves as right is very attractive and very powerful. Most of us don't wake up in the morning and go, yep, today's the day I'm just going to be wrong, you know. like we're it's just not how we operate. And it's going to be great. It's going to be awesome. I love Mondays when I'm wrong all day. We like to be right. And I think the attractiveness of being right is maybe what makes it so hard to resist saying, I told you so, when someone that we're close to says, I was wrong. By the way, if we want our intimates to be honest with us, if we want them to say, I was wrong, when they're wrong, saying, I told you so, is probably the very worst response we could give. If someone says, I was wrong, yeah, what, do you guys need to step out for a minute and work this out?
How could I
do this? That's hard, isn't it? Yeah. When someone that is close to us says, I was wrong, they are already acknowledging that we told them so. That's what that phrase means. So sometimes we just need to leave the moment alone, right, and let the letting go that's already happening to get to I was wrong kind of do its work. And if we can do that without looking smug, that's even better, you know, but that's way harder. Anyway, so all of this saying I was wrong might sound like a lot of work, at the end of which we simply have less clarity about who we are and less power to enact whatever we desire. So that doesn't really sound like work worth doing, does it? Like, I mean, it just sounds like, great, so I'm going to say I was wrong and, you know, I lose. And so the what's in it for me question just might come up. And in that regard, what I want to do this morning is leave us with a parable. Parables, of course, are stories that are meant to rub us the wrong way. They're meant to put things in parallel that don't fit well together to get us to really think about what we think. And so that's their function as a story form. And this one is no exception. This is a Jesus parable. And it's one way to read it is that it's about what's in it for us if we choose to enact the kind of letting go that comes from changing the way we think or believe about something, that we enact, I was wrong about something. So I'm just going to read you the parable as we have it in Luke, and then I'll say a couple things about it, and then I'll just let it sit with us and rub us the wrong way as we go, and, you know, we can do our own work, right? So here's the parable. This is from Luke 14. Jesus has been invited to a dinner party, wedding banquet. As it turns out, there's no place names at the place settings. The guests get to choose to sit wherever they want. So when Jesus noticed how the guests picked the places of honor at the table, he told them this parable. When someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. So, the host who invited both of you is going to come to you and say, give this person your seat. And then humiliated, you'll have to take the least important place. But when you are invited, take the lowest place so that when your host comes, he will say to you, friend, move up to a better place. Then you will be honored in the presence of all the other guests, for all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Well, there's lots there to consider, but here's what I want to emphasize today. Choosing to say, I was wrong, repositions us in the story of our lives, in this case, represented by this banquet table. It relocates us in the story. Whatever we're giving up, and we might feel this most acutely if we're giving up something that feels like it's our right to have when we're checking our privilege about something, whatever we're giving up, giving that up moves us to a place in which we can both receive care from others, which, not by the way, is one of the roots of learning compassion. We can't actually learn to be compassionate if we can't learn to receive care, which is kind of interesting, right? If you, like me, grew up with an enormous amount of privilege, the idea that I should be compassionate might feel like, yes, of course, I have a lot to share. I have a lot to give. I should give it, right? The idea that I actually can't truly learn compassion unless I learn to receive care, that feels like, what? Like, no, I'm the giver. You're the receiver. Well, guess what? If I'm the giver and you're the receiver, whatever I'm doing, it's not called compassion. Because for me to be compassionate, I actually have to be where you are. Which means I need to be, if you need care, I need to be someone who knows what it's like to need care. I need to experience from the inside out what it's like to be the one who actually is dying without care. That's compassion. That's the way compassion operates. So, when we say I was wrong, it repositions us in the story of our life. When we check our privilege about something, it repositions us in the story of our life in a way that means we can now begin to learn to receive care, which means we can now begin to know what it truly means to be compassionate. To suffer with, which is what the word means, someone. Interesting idea, right? It also means that we reposition ourselves in the story of our lives in a way that means we can now say to others, friend, move up to a better place. See, the person who does the best thing in this story is not the person who's hosting the banquet. It's not the person with the power that gets to do the best thing in this story. It's the person who gives up their power and privilege, who says, taking that thing that's my right to take because it's my right to take it, that, I was wrong. I need to move along from that. I need to no longer think of myself. I need to look at my own life and go, it is no longer helpful for me to think of myself as a person who goes to the head of the table because it's my right to do so. Is it true that it's my right to do so, socially, culturally, economically, whatever way we're measuring? Sure. Yeah. I'm best friends with the host. I'm cozy with whoever's got the money, the power, the influence, the cultural cachet. I come into the room, I go to the head of the table, nobody looks twice. Of course I go to the head of the table. It's my place. I got pulled over by a cop one time who was having a bad day, and what I had done was not egregiously reckless, but it also didn't follow the letter of the law about how slow you're supposed to slow down when you're going past an emergency vehicle on the side of the road, country road. It was just their emergency vehicle and me, and there was a whole road. I thought I left them lots of room. They didn't. They pulled me over, and they yelled at me. No, they stayed outside the vehicle and they yelled at me through the window. It could have been worse. But I got dressed down, not about the detail, although that got covered, but I got dressed down in a way that made me feel their anger. And their anger was bigger than the offense, as far as I was concerned. The offense was totally legit, but what was coming in through that window, that started some other day. And it arrived with that altercation. I was really shaken by that experience. I got to where I was going. I described it to a colleague who happens to be someone who has spent their entire life/career living and working with the disenfranchised. She said, she just kind of looked at me like, oh, you poor white boy. Like, do you understand that the majority of the world gets addressed like this by that position all the time? Right. That's right. So when I come into the room and I carry my privilege in with me, I can go to the head of the table. And nobody's going to say, you shouldn't go to the head of the table. I mean, I guess it could happen. Jesus says it could happen. It might happen, and I'm going to be embarrassed. I'm going to get caught out for, you know, rolling out my entitlement full blast, right? I'm going to look like an idiot and feel like an idiot. Depending how deep that goes, I might not do that again next time. But I might, because it's my right. So when I give that up and go to the foot of the table, metaphorically speaking, I go sit in the place that the person who walks into that story, not a person of privilege, probably goes to by a combination of instinct and brutal experience. And from that place, I begin to learn compassion. And from that place, I have the occasion to say, friend, move up to a better place. This one's taken, you know? You should be up there. You should go there. I believe we move along. We move along if I can say I was wrong. Peace.